The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Okay, let's get started for the last panel of the day. My name is David Spratt. I'm also one of the full-time faculty here at WCL. I'm alumni of the school. Welcome. And we are going to do something a little bit different. First, because we started a little late, we're going to probably run a tiny bit late, and then you'll be able to have the reception and whatnot. But we're also going to use visuals. And so if the technology works, you know, it's late in the afternoon. We're hoping you can focus on here. But first, I want to introduce the panelist. Jason Eister is the director of the Asylum and Immigrant Rights Law Clinic and assistant clinical professor of law at Ave Maria Law School. Professor Eister practiced immigration law in Ann Arbor for 9 years before joining Ave Maria. Prior to that, he served first as executive director of the Princeton in Asia Foundation, and then in the same capacity for the University of Michigan's Southeast Asia Business Program. He's a graduate of Princeton University and Fordham Law School, where he was the founder and editor-in-chief of the Fordham International Law Journal. At the present time, he is conducting research on the nexus of legal analysis and artistic expression, and he will be our first speaker. The second speaker is Ruth Ann Robbins, and she is a clinical professor at Rutgers School of Law, Camden, where she holds a joint appointment in the legal writing and clinical departments. This semester, she's chairperson of the legal writing department. She's the president-elect of the Legal Writing Institute and is in the middle of planning the 2008 LWI Biennial Conference. Her scholarship focuses in two different areas of legal persuasion. One, virtual design as a tool of persuasion, and she calls herself the font queen of legal writing. And two, the role of storytelling in persuasion. She co-authored with Brian Foley the Fiction 101 article that is now cited in several legal writing textbooks as a primer for the elements of storytelling as incorporated into fact sections of briefs. Her most recent article focused on the importance of heroic archetypes and heroic journeys as a scaffold for the client's story. She's also contributed a chapter to the book, The Law and Harry Potter. She'll be building on that material. She was also one of the organizers of the Applied Legal Storytelling Conference that just took place in London. Our last speaker is Daphne O'Regan. She's the co-director of legal research, writing, and analysis at Michigan State University College of Law. She received her BA from UC Santa Cruz, her master's and PhD in classics from Cornell, and her JD from Michigan State University College of Law. Her publications include Rhetoric, Comedy, and the Violence of Language, and Aristophanes' Clouds, which is forthcoming, and I'm sorry, which has been published, and forthcoming, Sophistic Speakers in a Comically Natural World, a chapter in Inventio, Rereading the Rhetorical Tradition. Excited about having all of them, and we hope the technology will work.
Thank you, David.
Well, very good. Well, many of us have ideas about what archetypes might be, and we're glad to know that we almost anything we want. Having now been pursuing this study for the last few months, I found that all of you've spoken about all day is really the archetypes of another name. What's an archetype? Well, it is, as you can see, arche and typos are the first bold, and although Plato didn't specifically deal with it, you know, that was original form, and I know this idea, as you know better than I, that there was this cookie cut, which is the original perfect form, and what we saw and what we see around us are these phenomena, these shadows of reality, which are like the cookies that are each one perfect, and there's only that perfect form that exists that most of us will never get a chance to really visualize. And that is the archetype. On the other hand, Aristotle, and Aristotle said, no, just get a combination of past experiences. You take all the experiences you have that have what a chair is, and then you say, oh, I know what a chair is. It's all the chairs that I've seen before put together. looked at it a little differently and saw you have one specific experience. We talked about somebody with that first experience. First time you really saw a chair, that means you, this is what a chair is. And every other chair is a variation of that. It all stands on both that specific experience when you finally see that first realization. Then we come to the more modern theory with Jung and Joseph Campbell. And for Jung, there were these motifs which you can find throughout myth, throughout all of our stories, which are underlined, which allow us to, there are these archetypes that are hidden from us, but which are clear certain. They can be aware of, we communicate in various ways, various stories we tell, which will reveal these archetypes. We can't really generally speak to them. They're hidden metaphors, which are part of us. Campbell continued with that idea, and he said that these are biologically based expressions in many cases. Now, I'd like all of that, let me turn around, but there's right behind you, there's someone standing, he's got his hand on your head. Now, for most of us, we feel a bit alarmed. We can't see behind us, right? And so, for all of us, we share this discomfort of our backs. The fact that we have fronts and backs that we can move in this direction, we see in this direction. Those form for us a certain way of thinking about the world we all have. And I have a drawing here of a woodcock with my family doing it bird watching. Woodcocks can see, you can see, except for that little blue part, this is looking down on his head, he can see 170 degrees behind it. So our woodcock, I have a very different set of mythologies and myths and stories and archetypes than we do because they do have eyes in the back of their heads. We heard earlier today about Lakoff, and I saw that this is a very clear discussion about his views on this. And I would say that these eye scans, they feel like cognitive models, in many cases, really are archetypes. They're these models which, and he says himself, he says it's all oversimplified metaphorical understandings of reality. That we might not directly be aware of, but we really control the way we do look at things. There's been another narrow view area, which is and Alfred has been the chief exponent of that, that there is something shared within the legal community that creates an archetype, which really either epitomizes or expresses the spirit, the structure of this document. For example, messages to the child, he uses as language. You talk about, you know, all the problems that are faced with that, it's still the idea that this is an archetype. That habeas corpus rules against torture are, that they speak to our societal aversion to brutality. If we start going down the slippery slope, getting rid of rules against torture, it just is ripping up our whole sense of law, because this is an archetypal value. He also says that certain precedents are archetypal, like Brown versus the Board of Education. They don't merely stand for the specifics of segregation and integration of the schools, but they stand for so much more, and they by their nature form this archetypal basis for our entire legal system. I'd like to apply this, though, to dogs. If we would look at dogs, they're grieving to go over with you, what we've seen out from the events of the previous recently. Well, we don't have to go, we don't have to go back, that's okay, maybe it's too long. Okay. Oops, no, I don't want to go anywhere, I want to stay back where I was. That's fine. Anyway. Plato would say, there is this perfect dog, and all the dogs we see around it, they just don't set up that perfect dog. Aristotle would say, if you've only seen little dogs, then that's your archetype for a dog. A big dog comes in and says, I don't know what that is. That does not fit my archetype. Locke might say, is that first dog you had when you were a child? That is your dog. It's the archetype of dog. Jung and Campbell said, dog has been around with us in the dog for thousands and thousands of years. We have become associated with the dog. It's this idea of our need for protection, but also our fear of protection. Waldron would say that dogs, and particularly recently all this discussion about the dogs that have been tearing each other apart. And again, going back to our reason that everyone was so upset about this was because of our societal and legal aversions. And that's why the political discussion is such a concern for so many people. So invited or not, archetypes will come to all of us. Variations. We don't get over this doorway because one is not thousand numbers. And archetypes don't know this. Archetypes are a type of metaphor, a type of metonym, and they do come to us. They allow us, by using archetypes, we're able to combine this logical persuasion with the seductive persuasion, or as Blaise Pascal called it, vérité, this idea that we're able to reach deep into this and other metaphors into a response which over which we may not have control in a logical sense, but which speaks to us much more deeply than words can. I'm going to talk about briefly about three different ways that we can see archetypes or which archetypes are useful in the legal system. One of them is to distinguish between a classification. We tend to often look at laws and specific cases and see, well, does that fit within this class? For example, I deal with asylum. And so we say, well, these are all the different asylum cases. This is what we have. Does this fit within the class of asylum? Does it meet these different elements? On the other hand, there are archetypal ideas of asylum. And I often will hear students say, well, if anybody should get asylum, this person should. And they're not doing that because they're saying, this one is person fits all the elements, but because that story just seems to mirror the archetype for what asylum is. And in many cases, it will be very different from the other type. And it's important for us, I think, to realize that when we do think about individual cases, often we don't view them just within the class. So we do look at the archetype. Like we're very familiar with the archetype. For example, in the case we had this last session where the woman had gone on to Kanye and all these things were going against her because she didn't fit that archetype, even though we could say that she was within the class, that those who should be the second area I'd like to talk about is the importance of the insignificant moment for the obtuse object. And these are ways for us to get to the archetype. As I said, Campbell and Jung talk about how we can't directly approach this archetype. And Plato did as well. So it's hidden from us. Yet it's very powerful. It's in our minds. It's hardwired as well as culturally derived. And often, we can look to an insignificant moment in the story, some special detail, which will illuminate that archetype for us. Rousseau said, for example, it's revealed in the value tells of a great man's nature of what he is. So you don't have to say necessarily that this great man won these battles and did this and did this. There may be some small moment in a man or woman's life in which their true dignity, the true value of their existence is revealed. And in our stories, the big pieces, we find another moment, not the great scene where the child is ripped from the mother and taken away by the father. And maybe there's something else that will bring to us the true humanity and the archetypal value of this. This is the most popular, most well-known photograph of the Vietnam War, and it's called Napalm. And it doesn't show any napalm. It doesn't show any fire. It doesn't show all of the horrible things that went on with it, but it shows just how these children running away. Yet one of the children, one of the soldiers, they're both looking back to see what's happened because they just can't stop looking at the world. We don't see the napalm, and yet we're very much aware of it. We don't see the fire. And I try to get my students to look for these moments away from the central action, but it will reveal the archetypal nature of the story. Similarly, Jericho was caused a tremendous change in the way that the French through the colonial system with this painting of the raft of Medusa. The big ship and it sunk. It was a terrible mess. Lots of stupidity. There was cannibalism and all these terrible things happened, but he didn't need any of that. He made it the moment at which they saw in the distance that help was coming. And he wanted to show a little forward, as we talked about earlier about this, and they had birth and participation. And this is these people were just about to be saved, so stretched up and had the opportunity to try and move forward and change their system. The object also, the little object, everything can serve as a way of leading for us to find the archetype. Particularly I see these as metonyms, and that's the way that one thing will resemble another or a part of that. So for example, earring. You see an earring and that can symbolize an entire person. I wanted to talk for a moment about metaphors as well as I hear a great deal of about dogs and cats, and my summer in 1975, the beach with Bowser, all these different images which correspond. And we can mention any one of these. And we'll bring the wet dog smell in the house. What I'm talking about, we'll know that the dog's there. It'll conjure up other ideas for us about what home life was like. If you look at paintings, you can also get ideas of how painters find these specific objects. And Jan Steen, the Dutch painter, would fill his pictures with little objects. Each one of them reveals something about home life. How about this quote by Alice Huxley? It says, the whole story of the universe is included in any part of it. The meditative mind can look through any single object and see as through a window the entire cosmos. And again, if you read through cases, you're not going to find one of the parts of the universe. You find one little detail, which will do that. And we'll do that more than telling, than showing rather than telling. And again, all man-made or select objects express cultural value. The way today, the way you have the paper range in front of you, the way you have the drinks, how you're sitting, all of these reveal something. So those little details, again, can be so powerful, all can be archived. These are some objects that were identified by Clinic. Newly planted flowers, a toilet seat, a book bag, a silk scarf, birthday candles, professional wrestling program, gold bottle. With the book bag, it was a silent seeker, and she was viewed because of that. She was from an African country. They just saw her as a victim. And then she talked about how she was being cut by the soldiers. She lost her book bag that she was carrying. And suddenly this idea that she was like them, she had a book bag, and now she's not being the archetype of the African strange person victim, and she became the student. She's a law student, it turned out. And so now she fit into an entirely different category, and the students became horrified. They wouldn't be able to cover her or before they really just thought, well, life is tough over there. Another example, indentures. There was a case in which, this was not one of mine, a prosecutor talked about a terrible rape and murder of an 8-year-old woman and one of the man that entered her apartment. He hit her so hard that her dentures fell out of her mouth and landed on the floor of the living room, and he took her to the bedroom and killed her. And that was a terrible lesson, blood and all. And he didn't want to show the jury about that. He just said that's too horrifying. They left nothing to the imagination, nothing you can even cope with. But he kept going back to these dentures, and the dentures on the floor. And he didn't quite know why, but somehow that object seemed to reveal her, as I said earlier, her age, her infirmity, her dignity, loss of dignity, the silencing, the weakening of her through the loss of the dentures, as well as the power in contrast, Dahl and Baumhaus was too obvious, too intense. Those are not the details that we need to do this archetype. This picture actually comes from Katrina in New Orleans. And it's just sort of say, if you thought there's a media thing. Wishby Gore, I think, was one of their little chants. And they could,
this little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it.
And it's one that we see in the Star Spangled Banner of saying, when you see by the dawn's early light, spiritual use of divination, the oracle seeing the light. All of these, they're powerful archetype, and I think it does come to the precision that comes through that. Another case which the silent seeker was sharing a pomegranate with a French woman from Chibourg. She was an African woman working for French women, and then these anti-French people came in and beat her up. And the fact that she was thinking that they were eating a pomegranate together seemed very significant for those of us who have a background in plastics, because the pomegranate river was so central that for Stephanie ages, a few of those little beautiful seeds, and because of that, she's condemned to the underground. Similarly, this woman, because she shared a pomegranate with her French employer, was linked in such a way that now she went back to her country in Africa. She would
success of a symbol or a sign like this to reach in our pledge depends on a shared background. And so one of the challenges to the judges, to the juries, share these same images that our students or the clients find. When it works, this significant object, a significant moment, will call forth the relevant archetype, and that will open the access to a compassionate, empathetic understanding of the narrative. So it's not an archetype place narrative, but archetype taking narrative even farther by revealing what is some of the depth. One of the interesting things about archetype is that we typically cannot, out of our mind, include the archetypes. I don't know if you're familiar with this great drawing, and you can see it either as a rabbit's head or as a duck's head. And you can go back and forth. You can't see the bones at the same time. You can spend hours if you have that back and forth. Back and forth and back and forth. Duck rabbit, duck rabbit, duck rabbit. It'll never resolve itself. Your mind will either see the duck or the rabbit. And the reason I bring that up is it's very valuable because when you're faced with the archetype, there are some things that you can use as strategies. One of these is to choose to do conflicting archetypes. So, for example, where the other side is presenting the narrative and is implicit archetype, you can say, no, that's the wrong archetype. And you don't say that, but through the detail, through the incident, you can convince the judge that that's not the archetype that you should be looking at all. It's not the African victim, asylum victim. It is the law student drawn and stopped from being able to complete their course of study. 5 minutes, right? 9 minutes. The second is you can reframe the meaning of the particular archetype. And that, Lakoff, of course, writes a lot about reframing. And some examples in the law are reframing the family. Her 12 words that can't argue against the family. You can say if the family is not this sexually bonded man, woman, or child, the family should be seen as a nurturing bond. So looking at where is that bond? It's more important to honor a mother-child bond than it is to honor this bond of husband and wife. But that's the true family. So you can try to reframe the meaning of the archetype. Or you can try to create a new archetype, which I think is a very exciting concept. Oh, back with reframing the meaning of the archetype, I also like that. But I'm afraid that if you're old enough to remember in the presidential debates in 1984, was that he will be the oldest president back in the Bay of Pigs. John Kennedy said he was able to sleep for 7 days. How do you think he'll manage? And of course, Reagan said, I don't want age brought into this. I don't want my opponents of youth and inexperience to consider the decisions we should vote for. And so I think, does age, is government infirm, or is age wise and experienced? Keeping the same archetype, you're viewing it in a different way. But the great excitement is in creating a new archetype, allowing you and your students to go forward and create this new archetype. And I wanted to quote here. Oh, maybe I have it on. Maybe I have it here. There. Thomas Carlyle wrote, like Prometheus, we can shape new symbols and bring new fire from heaven to fix it here, replacing the vague and superannuated, worn-out symbol. That's what we can do with lawyers. Because the old archetypes cease having significance in cases. I want to thank Patrice Phelps and David Spratt. And it's been a long time, right?
Yes.
Oh, thank you. Yeah.
Never thought of oh, wow, it's really very dark. there's just no way I'm going to be able to compete with Jason at this point. He was the breakout star, as far as I'm concerned, from the Applied Storytelling Conference. And, you know, you're not supposed to follow that kind of an act, but I'm going to do my best. I'm going to talk about one type of archetype, and that's heroes. And some of you probably know this already, actually, because several of you read my article in its many drafts, for which I thank you again. And what I'm really sort of talking about today is the beginning of the next step of what I'm up to, and I'm certainly willing to, happy, please give me feedback on where I can go with this. But this is the pragmatics, or how we can bring it back to the law students. And I guess I'm going in the pedagogy route. And I'm doing this in my upper level writing and my DV clinic cases. So, with that, all right. And what I'm referring to is the two articles that I've worked on in storytelling, and I've been trying to figure out how they fit together, because I haven't been able to figure it out for a while. And it's finally occurred to me that really they were written in reverse order. And for those of you who are flowchart people, the handout has a flowchart, and if you are not a flowchart person, do not feel bad about it. Just ignore it. But for those of you who don't know what I'm talking about, the sites, the articles are there. So I actually think that you would start the storytelling process in a legal case. And when I talk about my cases, I'm really talking about first not jury trials, but bench trials. And I'm really talking about at the trial level, whether or not it is presenting the trial to judges, or whether you're writing a brief at the trial level. I'm really not handling appellate advocacy for all the reasons I asked questions of Linda this morning. I just don't know how it works in appellate advocacy yet, although I do have one example later. And when I say beware the federal rules of evidence, I'm really sort of also struggling with the fact that I deal in classical rhetoric, and it seems to me that ethos is not regulated at all, except that we should have a lot of it. Nobody ever says you have too much ethos. Stop with the ethos. Right? The rules of professional conduct are exactly the opposite. Same thing with logos. Nobody says you're much too logical, right? Being a Vulcan is really, really prized in law. However, pathos is the redheaded stepchild of classical rhetoric when it comes to legal analysis. We can have too much pathos. What happens if the victim impact statement is too emotionally persuasive? We get slapped down, don't we, with I'm sorry, but the prejudicial has outweighed the probative. And for that reason, I think that we really have to understand that emotional persuasion has to be subtly manipulated in legal practice. That doesn't mean we should stay away from it. I absolutely say to my law students, stop being automatons. You must put emotion back into your persuasion. You just have to do it very subtly, because you have a lot of judges out there who are happy to come to the law school and talk to your students about how they absolutely do not want lawyers to get overly emotional with the stories. And it's just that we're not there yet with respect to how to actually emotionally persuade them. So that's sort of what I'm struggling with. Okay, so we know that heroic archetype persuades. Thank you, Jason, for introducing us to Jungian and Campbellian archetypes. The reason why they persuade, if you buy into Jung Campbell, which I do, is that it's already there in our subconscious. So what I'm suggesting we do is teach our students to tap into it, because it's the form of persuasion that is response reinforcing. What does that mean? Well, if there's three forms of persuasion: response shaping, in which there is a brand new culture that we bring people into and teach them the customs and bring them into the culture of practice. And then there's the response reinforcing, where we reinforce every single day that, you know, if you leave your office at 4:35, you're going to hit traffic. And every day when you leave your office at 4:35, you hit traffic. You've reinforced it every single time. It's probably the easiest form of persuasion, although most of us will probably think of the third type, response changing, where we actually try and work against the response shaping and the response reinforcing. Heroic archetype, though, taps into stories that we already know how they're supposed to end. We root for the hero. Does the hero ever lose? No, not in our culture they don't. They win. Okay. Why is it persuasive? Because we identify with them. Because they are flawed, and we know that we're flawed. And I actually had a conversation yesterday with Lou Serco about how flawed are we? Are we 10% flawed? Are we 30% flawed? I think that it's safe to say we're, you know, let's look in the mirror. We're 20 to 30% flawed, right? But we're working on those flaws, and we see them, and we strive to overcome them. And we identify with people who do, like Princess Diana, who really was, when she started out, was nothing more than the shy die, Cinderella, will she marry her prince, ho-hum, People magazine, but turned into something so much more than that. Now, whether or not she actually did the work, whatever. But and, you know, Henry VIII, maybe he's the domestic violence batterer poster child, I don't know, but he's also the person who brought England into the Renaissance, really dragged him in. So the fact that he beheaded a couple of his wives is whatever. But we identify, you know, well, I have a domestic violence advocate, so. But these are both archetypes. It's the lover archetype who rose above herself. It's the ruler archetype who is able to transform his country or able to help his country, depending on your viewpoint. Okay. And the hero's journey, this is condensing about 12 slides into one, is a cycle. It is a recurring cycle. We are always on it. You are on a journey right now. You're probably on several. What are your journeys? I don't know. If you're on tenure track, you're probably on the SAGE cycle where you're trying to get tenure. Maybe you're looking for a job right now, in which case you're starting some other new adventure. Maybe you're in the process of parenting, at which point you're in some kind of heroic archetype cycle as well. And they always have the same aspects. There's a call to the quest. Whether or not it's something that you want to go on depends. There's the initiation, which is the longest part of the cycle, in which you are trained. You will face challenges. You will fail at those challenges. You will face them again. You will continue to fail until you finally learn whatever it is you need to make yourself whole and transform yourself, at which point you can slay the dragon and move on and teach others how to do the same thing, and then you'll start your new quest. So, and there's certain characteristics that happen within each of the journey or each of the stages. So, for example, there's the picture of the ruby slippers and the wand. You are given a talisman to help you on your journey. You're either given a talisman or an amulet. What's the difference? This is your cocktail party information for today. An amulet only protects. A talisman can protect or it can act. So a wand can do magic, but it can also protect you. It's a talisman, whereas a ruby slipper is really only protect, except they actually also took Dorothy home. So maybe they're also a talisman, but most people see them as the amulet. When you wear a cross, you're wearing an amulet. It's there for protection. It doesn't actually actively do something. Well, at least most of the crosses I've seen. So, okay. Why am I spending some time on it? Because your client is somewhere on this journey. Where, and the lawsuit is something within the journey. They are on a life path. The lawsuit is not the whole path. It's only one stage. It may be somewhere initiation. It may be, you know, the actual slaying of the dragon. It may be the call to the quest. Don't know. Talk to your client. So, and you get lots of choices. You know, the American diet is mostly warriors, but we've got a lot of other options. And I actually think that warrior at this point is probably best left to, if you're representing somebody with a disability, could be a warrior hero who's not battling an external dragon, but maybe battling, you know, the sort of dragon that of society that's set up to serve bipeds as opposed to people who can't walk on two legs. Otherwise, you've got your outlaw hero, somebody who is standing up to the system saying there's something wrong with our society. We have to change it. So I actually see Stan from South Park as our modern-day Huck Finn. So we have the jester hero, who's not just somebody who makes you laugh, but is somebody who's trying to change society through laughter. And I should think Jon Stewart, Stephen Colbert are excellent examples of people who are on that kind of a life path. Harry Potter, who, as anybody who knows me knows, I'm going to talk in Harry Potter eventually, is the orphan hero, which is a very powerful one that you can often use. I think people overlook it for client representation. An orphan hero is somebody who has been abandoned by society and who is trying to regain a place in society. Now, this comes up in criminal cases a lot. I have one right now where I'm working with a student who's rewriting a bench memo, and it's a story in which a juvenile committed a Megan's Law offense, had to register under Megan's Law as a juvenile. The public defender, the first set of public defenders, lost his file at some point, so and as did a prosecutor. So during some round of indictments for him failing to verify his address or re-register or something like that, who can keep it straight? That becomes important. They lost his file, so the court had to dismiss an indictment and say, so sorry, go on your way. By the way, know the difference between registration and verification. Who knew the difference? Nobody knows the difference, yet they expected a 15-year-old to know the difference. His mother kicked him out of the house because her new boyfriend didn't like him. So he went to live with an uncle temporarily. Nobody told him that when he was 18, he could actually have the whole file closed and he wouldn't have to deal with this registration verification mess anymore. So, you know, and you just have this picture of the public defender's office with files everywhere and things just getting lost. It's not the fault of the public defenders, it's the fault of the system. Nevertheless, at 18, he was picked up for failure to re-verify his address. He wasn't even sure where he was living, so how could he possibly re-verify it? He had been orphaned by everybody, by the public defender, by his mother, by his mother's new boyfriend, by another set of public defenders. That's an orphan hero that you can call upon, and I'm trying to get students to see that it's not just the warrior, the athlete. You know, they're not just calling on Luke Skywalker at the time. It's actually somebody like Harry Potter who spent his whole time figuring out how to fit back into a society that really had lost him. Students are on a stage journey. And I make this point to my students by saying every single one of you is on the same journey. It is journeying towards becoming a lawyer. What's the ultimate dragon? It's not me. It's not the paper you have to write for me. It's the bar exam. So know that you're on it. Is that actually how you want to portray your client? And as Jason explained, that can be a very powerful story to tell or to tap into because we understand what a stage hero is supposed to do. And then I gave you some other examples of the caregiver, which is, it's not just the mother and child, although, yes, this picture is a mother and child. It can be a corporation. That's a major corporation in a small town. That's a caregiver hero. That's somebody that's helping feed the town or, you know, keep people employed, maybe. There's the every person hero. That's somebody who had hot coffee spilled on them when they were just trying to get to work. You have your choices, and we'll go through examples. How do we do it? I take them to the Super Bowl. Gosh, I hope this works. Earlier in the course, they have been asked to analyze classical rhetoric through advertising, and I'm actually really glad that James Boyd White is not in the room because he was so opposed to the language of advertising, and I'm telling you, I'm actually using the language of marketing, which is different. Marketing is the placement of the product as opposed to the selling of the product. And so I'm not really modeling the I want nature, but actually the imagining of the product's placement in a person's life, and I say to them, we can rehearse figuring out your client's archetype by looking at a 30-second or 1-minute commercial, and you can tell me which kind of hero it is and where they are in their journey. So this is the active learning portion of the day.
Hey guys, just thought you might want to know, sales aren't up, they're down.
Want a new job? We've got the most. CareerBuilder.com.
Okay, how many people had seen that commercial before? Okay, all the guys. Okay, some people. Okay, so I'll call on Ken or Lou since I saw your hands go up. What kind of hero is the person there, not the monkeys, the person? Yes, he's an every person hero. Where is he on his journey? It's okay, you can ask for him. Well, he's actually, I think it's more the beginning, isn't it? The call to the quest?
Mm-hmm.
I think it's the starting of the journey towards a new job. He needs a new job. Right. Right, but he doesn't, but he's got to leave it. Right. Well, that's true, and he actually started out kind of being the outlaw, right? The mm-hmm. Stan from South Park, because he's trying to change them. Guys, it's actually this way, and they're not listening to him, so let's go start a new journey towards a new job. What's Career Builders going to do for him? Well, they're going to help him build his talisman. What's the talisman? His resume. They're going to help him with his resume and the placement of his resume. They can't do it for him. They're just the mentor figure, but they can help him. Start to work. Okay, so the next one, I just have to give some background for people like me who had to actually look this up. These ads are both from the 2006 Super Bowl, which my husband instructed me to explain was from the 2005 season, and therefore I should not refer to it as the 2006 Super Bowl, but as Super Bowl 40, because that makes a difference. In which Pittsburgh was playing Seattle, and Hines Ward of Pittsburgh eventually won the MVP, and he's one of the people you're about to see. And I'm going to trust that we're all of the generation that we understand the literary, historical, whatever you want to call it, reference.
I'm going to Disney World.
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 What do you mean, be more natural?
Oh.
Take your head out.
Okay.
I'm going to Disney World.
Oh, I'm going to Disney World.
I'm going to go to Disney World.
Disney World. Disney World.
Okay, you should know that anything Disney does is deliberate, is brilliant, and we should be emulating it. They're the most powerful marketing force in the world, I'm convinced of it. They are better than McDonald's, they are better than Coke. And here, they're actually playing into their brand. Their brand is, we bring you magic. So, and it's actually deliberate. There's people who have written books that that talk about the deliberate use of heroic archetype in the branding of certain products. And Nike does it deliberately, and Disney does it deliberately, and Pepsi does it deliberately, and basically everybody with a really big budget does it deliberately. And everybody else should just read the book. Okay. So who were these people? These were MVP hopefuls. Now, a lot of the men in the class who get sick of the Harry Potter and Disney princess references do get this. What amazed me was how many of them did not understand the reference to the I'm going to Disney World. Apparently, that's just getting dated. I'm assuming people here understand?
No.
Okay. So the story is that when you win the Super Bowl, somebody shoves a microphone and says, well, you just won the Super Bowl. You're the MVP. What are you going to do? And what's the answer? Right. That started many, many Super Bowls ago, and so it's the traditional. No, I understand. I'm like trying to think about the California comeback, but okay. Fine. The point is that where are these football players in their journey? They're at the very end, aren't they? They're about to slay the dragon. Somebody is going to win the Super Bowl, and somebody's going to be the MVP. And what do you get when you finish? You get the magic elixir, and then you get to tell everybody else about it. Mm-hmm. So what's Disney? Disney's the magic elixir. You win the Super Bowl. You win the MVP. You get the major prize, the major magical prize. What's the major magical prize? Disney World or Disneyland.
Mm.
So, and students do get this. They do respond to it. I have to say that the 2007 Super Bowl ads were pretty bad. So I'm really hoping that 2008 brings us a bumper crop. But pretty much you can ruin students' watching of commercials forever by asking them to start looking for heroic archetypes everywhere and identifying the type of hero that actually, as an athlete, was a warrior hero, and the place, the journey, and what the product or what it is, message that is trying to be sent. All right, so bringing it back to legal writing. Now, in this one, which is a Dove commercial, I'll say this for anybody who's seen it, who gets all choked up like I do. note how Dove casts the viewer. The viewer is absolutely the mentor who is given a task to do to help these heroes. Oh, no, but we're going to have to end the show because I just ruined it. Sorry. Sorry.
Don't be unhappy, can't remember when I last saw you laughing. If this world makes you crazy and you've taken all you can bear, you call me up because you know I'll be there. And I see your true colors shining through. I see your true
go. It's supposed to be rainbow at the end. Okay. Do we start to see how this one actually ties back to what we, the writers, we, the attorneys, are supposed to be doing? When I watch this commercial, I do get emotionally choked up, and I feel like it's time for me to write the big check to the Dove Campaign for Real Beauty. And that's exactly what they want us to be doing, is they've cast us, you know, if we think about it in a legal concept, they've cast us in the role of judge, and they've asked us for resolution. They have said, please help these people. These are heroes. Are they innocent heroes? Are they explorer heroes? Are they siege heroes? I don't know. You can ask, you can characterize them however you want of these, you know, young women to be. But we're asking you, Your Honor, to help them bridge the gap into adulthood and remain emotionally stable and not destroyed like so many of us who were once teenage girls were, ran the risk of being, or were. So that's how I bring the students back into legal writing, by saying, look how the mentor, first of all, we were cast as the mentor. We are not supposed to save these girls. They have to save themselves or they will not be whole. They cannot be saved. They can only be mentored. And the judge, the viewer, was given a task to do to help them on their journey. And that's what our storytelling must do. That is what the message we must leave, is that the judge is not the hero. The judge has a great role to play. The judge can feel very good about himself or herself at the end of the day with their task to do. But it is still the job of the client overall to get back to their life. Okay, so that's the sort of the meta structure, is that you have to know your client. You have to be able to pick out, is this a victim from Africa who needs asylum? Is this somebody who is a sage whose story of learning how it was a law student in Africa was interrupted by this attack, and we got to help this person get back onto their path because they've been bounced off the path by whatever it is. And once we know which archetype we are going to be using and tapping into, we stick with it. We should be knowing things about our client. That means that we've given a great variety of options. But once we zero in on, okay, this is the scholar hero, we're going to develop the character of our client in the brief or in the closing argument or whatever, through testimony, that's going to allow that character to develop. And it's going to also drive the conflict. The conflict is not necessarily with the other side. The conflict may be with, this person needs to get back to law school so that she can, you know, fight for the bar exam or whatever it is. And so it's a different conflict choice. And that actually, once we do that, allows the casting of the other roles to naturally take place. And the judge's role is in this maze will always be a helper person, not the actual hero. Okay, and that actually, I mean, again, it's asking your students or asking lawyers to figure out where the story of the lawsuit fits in with the bigger story of the client's heroic path. You know, is it the call to the quest? Is it the road of trials? You know, is the other side really just like the apple tree in The Wizard of Oz, who's throwing apples at Dorothy so that, you know, she's trying to get food so she can stay on her yellow brick road, and the apple tree is going to try and grab her, if we remember the movie. The first, the apple tree grabbed her, and then her friends figured out that it would be easier to call names at the apple tree, so they started so the apple tree would throw apples, which would allow her to get the sustenance she needed to get back on the path. So what is it that, I mean, how are we casting the other side? How can we actually nuts and bolts do it? We can evoke with implicit metaphor. I have to say that on your handout, there's a font typo there. It's in the wrong font, and I am deeply ashamed that that happened, so I'm sorry. Now, this is the phrase that I promised you was going to bring Linda Edwards' stuff back, because this is actually from an appellate brief, and it's actually supposed to be evoke with implicit literary metaphor. You can tap into archetype by calling up a story that we already know that plays into one of the established archetypes. And in this one, the court actually was cast as the hero because it was an appellate brief, and that's probably why I've been able to love it and yet not understand it at all. Mm-hmm. And everybody understands these phrases that are highlighted in purple. We get what it calls up, right? We get the visual imagery. Okay, and it's calling up Odysseus and the sirens. So it's actually fun for students to go, wait, I get that. It's so cool. That was actually written by one of our other legal writing professors. It was his writing sample to get a job, and it was just one of the, and so we call it the sentence that got Jason the job. Okay, and what Jason was just talking about is actually something else I've been teaching my students, is that all of the things that we learn in basic legal writing about how you use detail to emphasize and you use lack of detail to de-emphasize, you can use detail to create visual imagery. And you can use that small moment. So, for example, what is the visual moment of the Red Riding Hood story? What is it that we call to mind? Okay, volunteer? All right, we call the story her seeing the wolf, right? That's not the actual climax of the action, but it is the visual that we have in our mind. And so, you know, it's the moment when she sees Grandma in wolf's clothing. It's so outside of what we expect that it's what we remember from the story, although the climax was actually when the woodcutter killed the wolf and saved Red Riding Hood. So, and that's the sort of thing that's bringing in Jason's work. This is also a shameless plug for the article I'm working on, which is about poster presentations. And anyway, my time is up, so I certainly would love to hear feedback on what can you do with this in the next sort of pragmatic article. Thank you.
Needs to stop showing.
You introduced me to the writer's journey.
It stopped? No.
Right? Mm-hmm. And he talks about not seeing the archetype.
All right, just a sec. I knew this was going to happen. Okay, but I want it to stop now.
I disagree with him. I could think.
Oh, that's right. I'm supposed to use this.
He says that they don't have to.
I said that if you change moves, you get the mask for somebody in the past.
Right. All right. Let's see. I hope this works. My topic is a little bit different. My topic is delivery. Delivery is the fifth canon of classical rhetoric. What that is extremely important. It has been recognized as the single most important thing in rhetoric since the age of at least Demosthenes, when asked by famous story that everybody knows, when asked by someone, what is the most important thing about rhetoric? He continued to repeat delivery until a person stopped asking. In other words, what you do with your body and your voice, those are the two aspects of delivery classically. Your body and your voice as you speak is vastly more important than what you actually say. There are so many ways that that is important in our legal system that it's hard to enumerate all of them. But the one that has particularly caught my eye is the concept of detecting deception. For at least the past 20 years, it's been clear to everybody in the legal field, ever since Wellborn's article, that social science has shown that that ordinary people absolutely lack the ability to detect deception in others. Absolutely lack the ability to detect deception in others. Detect deception. You can't tell someone's lying. Okay, that's impossible. You can show that people actually do about as well as chance in detecting lies. Highly trained people might get as good as 60%, but there's no reason to believe that anybody you've ever encountered in your life, let alone a jury, police officer, etc., are highly trained. In addition to that, Paul Ekman, who's the principal investigator of deception and detection of deception, has said that if you can think of a single way to make sure that people would not be able to detect deception, you would call it a trial as a concurrent position. Okay, so given all that we know about that, I ask myself the inevitable question. Okay, given all that, why are we still relying on credibility determinations? Isn't that really stupid? Doesn't it fly in the face of everything that people experience every day, that line of trial? We all know that we can be lied to if we believe it. Of course, there are many theories about. So I ask myself how to answer this in terms of classical rhetoric. Because classical rhetoric and the canons of delivery supposedly have to do with detection and deception. In order to answer that question, I want to go back to something that Perry said, which is that we shouldn't forget that everything that we're seeing is not disinterested. And if we ask ourselves what archetypes are, Jason said something that beginning and depression, but another way of using the same phrase is rule and strike. Beginning and rule are the same thing in Greek, and mold and strike are the same thing. And if you take the position that archetypes are those things which are struck by people who are empowered to maintain their power, you will have a slightly different understanding of the role of archetypes, and perhaps one that is a little bit more aligned. So, assuming that delivery, of course, became an issue when democracy became an issue. Prior to democracy, it really didn't matter how you said things. If you had the ability to make whatever you said come to pass, then delivery was not an issue. So, delivery and rhetoric sort of arose together. And originally, there was only a lead delivery, and therefore there was no delivery at all. By the time the mechanism that we're all familiar with, which is as long as there's only one standard, that standard can be completely naturalized and not be a standard at all. So, the time paradigm, although some of the sophists, notably Thrasymachus, the same Thrasymachus who appeared in the first book of the Republic, by the way, wrote a book about feels of pity, which was probably about delivery. We don't have any of that left. Because Aristotle hated delivery, got rid of most of the work of the analysis. In any case, we have Heracles, and he was every man, the entire cultural tradition, and now probably, the paradigm for excellent delivery. And this is characteristic of Heracles' delivery. This is a quote in English. From Plutarch's Life of Pericles, and discussing Pericles, of course, being a leader of Athens for most of his adult life. He had seen a spirit that was solid and a discourse that was lofty and free from plebeian and reckless effrontery, but also a composure of countenance that was never relaxed into laughter, the gentleness of Charis' lovely gentle, and a cast of attire that suffered no emotion from the spirit but rather was speaking. Modulation of voice that was far
very wide and then black. This is what paraclete looked like.
And you will immediately recognize that Pericles, whoops, now let's see. Okay, guys, I knew this was going to happen. Just bear with me for a minute. How do I make this come back over here?
What are you trying to do?
Oh, I'm trying to make it come over here. Because I can't move through it unless it's over here.
What do you mean, over here?
I have to be able to control it from here.
It's not.
No.
What if
Can
you
get the tech guy to come and fix this? In a minute, I'll show you what Pericles looks like.
The point of that is that if you see this picture of Pericles, you'll recognize it. Of course, Pericles is kind of standard for the rational man. When I say man, quite intentionally, because for many thousands of years, only men could be rational. And you'll see when I am able to show his picture.
Oh, spoiled.
Oh, you're brilliant. Oh, it's so good to have brilliant people on the panel with me. Okay, but it's still not, okay, these are comic guys. And now I've made David go and look for, there's Pericles. Oh, you can't see him very well. But anyway, that's Pericles.
Now, Pericles and most upper class Athenians who were fortunate enough, that's a Roman copy actually, Pericles, to have statues, all look remarkably incredible how similar the statues in that period are. And it's because all rational beings look the same. We are all trained to understand and believe. And in fact, James Boyd White is telling us that this morning. Sorry, he's not here, I wanted to talk to him about it. That the just man speaking justly will be believed, that we all know what that looks like, and it looks like the same for everybody, regardless of what you actually look like.
So it's very important for people to fit into that paradigm. And if I were to read you,
this is how contemporary trial manuals believe that you should look when you are speaking, particularly at the appellate level. And I'm sure we've all started to think about this, and I know I have. You must make a neutral stance or new gather stand squarely with your feet, approximately shoulder width apart, lay your hands at your sides, don't block your knees, put your weight on the balls of your feet, so very authoritative. Great standing in front of the audience. You must make natural hand gestures. I love that. You must make natural hand gestures, of course. It will help you remain solid and grounded. Although you might feel uncomfortable even though you're being natural, you will look calm. Superfluous movement only damages your argument and credibility. That is typical advice. Here's the description of Justice Ginsburg. She was still acting mad because I think captured perfectly the extent to which everyone will fit into this paradigm according to the standard rational. But of course, Justice Ginsburg's former. She stands erect behind the podium, her feet together, she speaks in a low and really finished voice. She does not gesture. She's completely sure, totally prepared, meticulous in her knowledge and details of her argument, that's good. And she is utterly convincing. When the justices query her, she listens attentively and slightly bowed. Her answer shows she has understood the questions and appreciates their force. She does not shrink from the challenge, she knows this battle will not be won on a day she is prepared for a long campaign. This is the battle imagery that was being referred to before.
And it is very important to understand the relationship between Pericles, the battle imagery, and the possibility of truth. Hey, I just put this in for fun. This is such a cool picture.
This is a caricature of a sophist on an ancient Greek posture. I love that picture.
Guy has obviously been thinking too much. Here's Aeschines. He's in a classicizing mode. Now, there are two reasons why you shouldn't move your arms in a loop.
Now we go through our arms because a loop delivery has a rule. We must go in for a little rational. And I am not going to rationalize anything like this. I can assure you that my credibility, if I were standing here and go like this, but in the old days, it was important not to move your arms, among other reasons, because the elite costume was quite difficult to maintain either toga or the main flow, and you had to remain relatively stationary.
Now, there's another reason why your posture, you see that he's quite straight. This is Demosthenes. Okay. Why is your posture so important? Let me go to that first slide that I showed you. Here, this is why your posture is important. And why the painting central image, in my opinion, of credible argument. That guy is either a street musician or a comic actor. There's a little bit of debate about this very beautiful fresco. But in any case, he exemplifies something that is the opposite of belief posture, which is slump. Why do people assume that posture? Because of violence. Because people are protecting themselves, and they're huddling together. A man or woman with belief posture is showing that he or she is not afraid of violence. All lower place people, when you read descriptions, for example, of ancient actors, they will comment that they were very skilled in characterizing the characteristics of slaves. A mark of slavery and people who are vulnerable is that they will have that particular posture. And you can see it repeated over and over again in the ancient statues. The reason that you cannot, and it's perfectly clear in contemporary trial, and I'll read you a few passages if I sit around to it, that there is a strong correlation between the credibility of posture and rationality. Why? Because that posture means why can you lie? You can lie because people who are vulnerable have to lie. They're required to lie. Now we're getting to why credibility determination is important. It's important because in this understanding, people who do not have the correct posture are representing themselves as potential liars. The same thing can be said of your face. I suppose you remember what Pericles' face looked like. This is what a characteristic slave mask of comedy looks like. People who are vulnerable have disturbed faces because they are prey to unpleasant emotions. One of Pericles' most notorious and famous attributes was his absolutely rigid self-control. When he learned that his sons had died in battle, he went and gave counsel to the people completely unmoved. This was very important in building his credibility. Therefore, it's very important, unless you have particular legal needs, that that people preserve a smooth countenance. Otherwise, they're fitting within the archetype, you might say, of irrational people who may lie, etc. And I could go on for walking. Walking is extremely important, and I'm sure you'll appreciate in just a second why that may be. Here are some people who are not walking. I invite you to guess the class of the people on the left. I'm sure that everybody recognizes the people on the left are probably from a vulnerable social class, right? And they are, because they're representing certain comic figures in mime, which is primarily a low-class theatrical phenomenon. So, one of the reasons that you have to have a lead posture and so forth is because of your vulnerability to force. But that's not the only reason. The other reason that you have to have elite posture and so forth in order to be credible is because you're not only vulnerable to force and you're not among the elite, you are vulnerable to desire. The comic figures make this play very clear. Here's a typical comic figure. Actually, this is very striking. I'm embarrassed about showing some of the things that I could have shown. But it's characteristic of comic figures that represent low-class people that they have large stomachs. This is comedy. Comic actor and a tragic actor. You can see that comic actors who typically represented low-class people, because that's the nature of comedy, has a special suit that all of them wore, and it causes them a very large stomach. And that's important because from the time of the Odyssey to the beginning of the speech and people who are enthralled to their stomach will speak whatever is necessary because the stomach will determine what they say. So that's another thing that's wrong with low-class deportment, like scratching, for example. Anything that you can do to indicate less than total control of your body, for example, scratching or tapping your foot or whatever you can think of, there are many examples, playing with your hair, any kind of foot, indicates that you have abdicated control of your mind, and your body is controlling some portion of you, at least, if not all of you. So that's the model of elite deportment and what it can tell you about truth, because people who are prey to enforcement, people who are prey to environment, do not trust to be truthful. However, after Pericles, speaking of the monastery, moved in a more radical direction. It's called radical, which means that they started to select their leaders, not necessarily from the upper elite classes, but from the middle class. And the political power tended to depend more on what we might call that net, right, democracy, basically, than it had previously. So what happened was, this guy, Cleon, not a Cleon in Crete, but a different Cleon, a real Cleon, came to power, and this is how he would have characterized sitting on the ground of the head, who could never be dead of that. Here's some art on Cleon. When Pericles died, Nicias, who died assisted, held the headship of the men of distinction. That means he was a friend. And the head of the people was Cleon, who was thought to have done the most, this is how you corrupt people. The most corrupt the people was his impetuous outburst. He was the first person to use cowling and abuse as a platform. To gird up his cloak, you saw what I heard his speakers look like. I see. Before making a speech, he began to speak in a disorderly fashion. Later, they commented, worst of all, Leon stripped the dame on that's where you were standing there, fucking of his decorum, setting the fashion of yelling when he heard the people, throwing back his cloak, slapping his thigh, and running about while speaking. Well, it's very fascinating how, well, first of all, we can tell immediately from that description that Cleon is personally corrupted because of all the things that I've already said.
Right.
Personally corrupted because he's not following leaders or failing to follow the informing, both that you're vulnerable and that you're violent and you have fire. But worse than that, when you don't follow the informing, you corrupt the people too. So it's like this contagious aspect to your personal vulnerability. And corruption spreads out and corrupts the people too. And that is an extremely important part of understanding what I call popular rhetoric. Cleon is an exemplar of popular rhetoric. And it is the rhetoric that is frequently adopted in someone in trial situations. Popular rhetoric has its own people who are in favor of it, but very few of them have written it. Because the rhetorical literature, by and large, is written by and for elite people. So the reason I'm bringing this up is because my belief that embedded very deeply in our understanding of how people speak is an understanding that not that popular literature has to corrupt these effects on the audience is also embedded very deeply into our understanding of jury trial. And so we find that tremendous effort to restrain advocacy in the trial, a tremendous belief that if the advocate does not adopt a legal delivery, that the jury trial is somehow tainted and that the jury has been corrupted. And I'm sure you can all think of millions of examples of that. It happens constantly. And I think it's written into our tradition rather than any actual facts. We know, for example, about, oh, I just thought, okay, juries. Well, here's my last thing I want to tell you about, and this is what I'm totally excited about, and it's extremely cool. And
That's this.
So we have Aristotle writing after Dumont. Aristotle is going to set himself up. Many of his horses are got rhetoric, there's a lot of belief, but not all of them. And he is commenting that he's going to write something in the spirit of rhetoric about the delivery, which is going to call actually style. And he's only going to talk about voices, but he makes this comment about delivery that I think is extremely important because it ties together a lot of things that I personally am very interested in. So he comments, first of all, untruthfully, no treatise has yet been composed on delivery. Well, that's definitely not true, but in any case, it isn't like once again, it's because it's a matter of style, by that he means delivery. So only lately can he know this. And rightly, it's considered to be thought vulgar. Okay, so what does that mean? Well, if you look at the word that he used in Greek for vulgar, more secret, quite interesting that that word is the word for comedy. In other words, it's extremely, this is why I'm showing you these pictures of comedy, but I don't have time to get into it. But so comedy and popular rhetoric that has only popular rhetoric is delivery. See, it's very important to remember that. Because elite rhetoric is natural, and it's how just man speaking just and actually looks. So it's very important. So this is cool because what is characteristic of comedy, and it has always been characteristic of comedy, at least in Greece, is that it has this multiple voice thing. And so then it's more responsive to the lower, it's called a low genre, because it's considered to be responsive to the body. Low social economic class concerns. And so what he does is he ties rhetoric, delivery, to comedy as a way of discrediting it. But what my ultimate goal is, of course, is to write something to show that actually that means that we are learning new truths from popular rhetoric and from comedy all the time that then seep up into the early discourse, not the other way around. But I'm obviously not going to get to talk about that, so I'm just going to stop.
Turn up the lights. If we have any questions, you can go to the mic.
Yes.
Oh, I should take my computer. I make this go off. I found your presentation very interesting, and I wanted to ask you if one of the deductions from your presentation, at least I get, and I just want to know if this is something that you're trying to convey, whether in those societies and that period, whether being funny or comedic was not considered cool or by the elite, or if even more broadly the elites just weren't funny. You know, I mean, see that, I mean there had to be people, and if you read, you know, the Greek myths, for example, and stuff, I mean, they were tragic comic figures, you know. I mean, they were funny even though they weren't trying to be. I mean, they were just so stupid and silly that they were funny, you know, in hindsight. So that was one thing I wanted to ask you. And just a side note, I like that your notion of the control of the body, and I'm wondering whether you can make some comment about whether you were trying to say that this is still true, where you know, in the process of delivery, you have to keep or maintain that sense of control in order to be effective, and how that sort of goes into the deception. I had a little difficulty connecting that up, but you know, that's okay. Well, What I wanted to say, when you go, first of all, I wanted to make the point that the way that we are training our students falls well within the classical tradition. And if I had had time, I wanted to talk about acculturation and say that one of the reasons that I believe that we're controlling demeanor in the trial is because of acculturation, physical and mental acculturation that occur in tandem, so that people cannot abandon their demeanor assumptions without abandoning rationality itself, because it's become embodied into them and their understanding of the world. We inculcate that every day in our children and telling them not to run in the halls. It's not just a safety matter. We're teaching them about elite deportment. We inculcate it in law school. We teach our people who are doing oral argument to do it. I'm assuming that they're teaching popular delivery. I hope they're teaching popular delivery in trials, because I think it's important and effective. But that since we're, and so what you're doing in law school is you have this concept of you're learning to like to think like a lawyer and to act like a lawyer, to be a lawyer physically at the same time. And so you can't subtract out and tell somebody. It's very difficult not to make the set of cultural assumptions that are trained into us by and before law school, that certain ways of acting and seeing and being and waving your arms and scratching and not scratching and all those things are not indicative of rationality. And where it's very interesting to me is, and one of the things I was going to talk about, but I guess I got carried away because I love those comic statues, is that when you go into immigration law, for example, even though it should be clear and obvious to everybody that the same rules do not necessarily apply on a universal basis, they are assumed to apply on a universal basis anyway. And very frequently, for example, you'll see that someone will ask for a demeanor expert to come in and testify in an immigration kind of case, or where you have a case with people from other cultures, and it will be denied on the basis that there's this common sense understanding, and Mr. Eister and I were talking about this, that everybody knows what these things mean. Because in no way have we abandoned our elite cultural tradition that I think you can trace back very directly, and the belief that it shows us rationality and the necessity of believing in terms of jury trial that people can look at this and assess credibility. It's necessary for the structure of a trial for that to be true, the way trials are currently structured.
Other questions? Any?
Thanks. Let's see. Well, first, I just want to make an observation about the ordering of the panels today, which I'm going to assume was intentional. But I thought it was interesting that Linda Berger said that the narrative can't be understood without metaphor, and then Jason said that metaphor can't be understood without archetype. And so we sort of peeled back the layers of the onion in the order in which we've gone today. But it's sort of within that, I guess, that I wanted to make maybe a comment about the intersection or the relationship between particularly archetype and metaphor. So the Jungian definition, I think that you quoted, is as it's shared ways of creating meaning. An archetype is a shared way that we have to create meaning. And what I like about that, and what I think that the Aristotelian definition and the Lockean definition reflect, is that there's an experience base to the formation of archetypes. So you said Aristotle said it's a merged, maybe prototypical sense of our shared experiences, and Locke that it has to do with our first experience, the archetype. And I think experience, I have two points about that. One is it's what I like about the cognitive approach to metaphor, that it puts experience front and center. And, you know, from my comments before, I said that it starts to have you look at metaphor as a process for understanding things based on our physical interaction with the world. That helps us understand things that we don't have as much physical experience with. But what I think maybe the larger point is that I think when we get away from the notion of objective truth and sort of look more at experientially based learning, experientially based definitions of truth from an experiential standpoint, I think that's actually how we start to be able to change things. And I don't know if you had any comments on that. I guess it's particularly directed to Jason. But.
No, I agree. I will say that it's exciting to be in a location where other people have read the writings of Winter and some of the others. I know I was at Wayne State one day, and one of the I mentioned that I had read Stephen Winter's books, and the professor said, "Oh, you're the only one here in the whole law school who ever has." And so it's exciting to be in this with this group of people who are familiar with him and with Lakoff, and I think it's a very important area for us, for the legal community to be aware of the importance of cognitive psychology on understanding how we do think and how we understand, and that should have a tremendous bearing on justice. And it's up to us to get the word out so other people will read his books.
I have a question. Perhaps for Jason, but certainly everybody else can talk about it as well. Jason, you mentioned that archetypes work best when there's a shared background or a shared understanding. And I want to suggest that they, I don't want to get into the work best, but they also work powerfully when there is not a shared background. And I think your example of the African girl is a really good one, because she didn't have a shared background with your students at all. Then there was this one tiny little thing.
Well, that's why I was saying the importance of finding that object. You might find an object right. Which they don't have any similarity with. For example, in a case that I was at trial yesterday, it had to do with this fellow's yarmulke. He was a Jewish fellow who had been persecuted in Moscow. And the students chose to make a big deal of it, but I think that for the judge, he didn't understand the significance of it, that it was taken off his head. If it had been something else where that object, I think the archetypes are universal, but how do you, if indeed, as Campbell and the others say, it's something that is in our unconscious, how do you reach that? And if you have an object which does not ring to go to that's what I was talking about, that
right.
Challenge.
Yeah, I understand, but I just want to suggest that archetypes are a way of connecting people who have absolutely nothing in common. And archetype and narrative are so related. I mean, one doesn't exist without the other, again, because what the students brought to that was their own story of being a student, or in particular, a law student. And then they knew they shared that story with that girl. And so that was a way of connecting.
Yeah.
And I think it's one of the most I've written about the stories are a powerful way of connecting people who simply cannot understand each other in any other way. There's nothing they share, but perhaps some kind of archetypal narrative, like the grieving mother or the school girl or something like that. They are ways of crossing boundaries that are seemingly impossible to cross as well.
I can talk about that a little bit based on a case that I was actually trying this past May, which was it was a restraining order case. It was a 19-year-old trying to get a restraining order against her entire family, and because they were basically, it was the act that they had to focus on was harassment. We had to focus on was harassment, but it was really about false imprisonment and criminal restraint. This was a girl who had been sort of kept under her parents' thumb for all 18 months of her adult life. And it got to the point where she left for work and said, "I'm going to go have dinner with a friend." And the parents screamed at her, "You will absolutely get home, or we're going to arrange a marriage for you outside of the country." And so there was cultural differences that the judge was trying to make the focus of the trial, and that we were trying to spin back and saying, this is not going to be a trial of somebody else's culture. And so we actually were using, I didn't understand it at the time, but we were focusing on the objects and saying this was somebody who was living with parents who were ultimately so abusive that when she left for work that day, and it was, she knew, or she had a sense that she was leaving, she couldn't take anything with her except what she was going to take to work. It was September, and she couldn't even take one of the 5 winter coats that were hanging in her closet. She couldn't take any of her jewelry. She couldn't take her clothes. It was somebody who ultimately was leading an MTV Sweet 16 lifestyle. Everything was paid for, but she was a prisoner in her house, and we were trying to not let the judge use culture, but instead hook in on those winter coats that she couldn't have. So I think we were building bridges when the judge was trying to absolutely say this is just a cultural matter between a parent and child. And so, for what that's worth.
Let me just conclude briefly. I thank these panelists, and I think we should give them a round of applause. And I'd like to thank all of you for coming, and I hope that you've gotten lots of food for thought today. I'm trying not to wiggle too much. I scratch. I'm very self-conscious. Lots of food for thought, and I think we have only begun to plumb the depths, there's a metaphor for you, of the possibilities of thinking about and doing substantive work in what we do every day, which is work with students. We're in the ditches, or in working, getting our hands dirty, working with students on language and on their writing. And we think more about legal language and how it shapes reality, I think, than anyone else in the legal academy. And there's lots of ways that we can do excellent work and really bring to the legal culture better understandings of these things, which are incredibly powerful. And I do international human rights, and I've recently been doing work with violence against women and what we have to work with in terms of archetypes and narratives, typical narratives, stereotypical narratives when it comes to victimized women is so powerful and so important. So in many, many areas of law, these things are critically important. So thank you all for coming. We will, right about now, have a reception right outside here. And all of you are invited to dinner, which will follow in about 45 minutes in room 600, which you're finding out just follow signs in this building and you will eventually get there. So reception right now, and in 45 minutes or so, dinner. Thank you very much. Yes, Linda. And thanks to Paul, Jamie, David, and Jessica for helping out and for being here today, and for all you do for the program as well.